The Lisa Wexler Show podcast is brought to you by Winston Prep School for Kids with Learning Disabilities. Visit winstonprep.edu. Also brought to you by Onboard Services. For your staffing and engineering needs, go to onboardusa.com.
Attorney, advocate, author, public speaker. The Lisa Wexler Show. WICC 600. Flip that switch and turn on your brain. Here is Lisa Wexler.
And it's 6 minutes after the hour, 203-333-9422. In this hour, we'll chat with Margaret Cho. And, of course, I want to hear from you. So let me tell you some of the things on the agenda today. There is so much going on. I actually want to begin with a little bit of a different kind of a story. Take a breather from politics for a minute. And talk about this McDonald's. Because, you know, McDonald's is in many ways the great equalizer. I'm not a McDonald's person. I mean, I can't pretend to be somebody that I'm not. The only time my kids ever got to go to McDonald's was on a trip. And they got to go to McDonald's because there were virtually no choices years ago when we went on a trip. It was McDonald's or nothing. But I credit McDonald's with having some of the cleanest restrooms in America. They're always clean. They're always welcoming. The people in them don't say, oh, if you don't buy French fries, you can't use our restroom, unlike some other private entities. And so I credit with McDonald's, and particularly lately, have you noticed how they have redone the outside? They put a lot of money into the way they look, and they try very hard to be good neighbors in their communities as a rule, except for the fact, in my view, that they serve, you know, pretty junky food. But here's what I wanted to talk with you about at 203-333-9422. May I predict your order is the headline. And it talks about, in today's business section of the Times, how McDonald's is planning to act like big tech in order to sell you more Big Macs. Over the last 7 months, McDonald's has spent hundreds of millions of dollars to acquire tech companies that specialize in artificial intelligence and machine learning. And they say that they even have something called the McD Tech Labs, where a team of engineers and data scientists are working on voice recognition software. So you know this is a whole thing for me, right? You know how I feel about this, about the voice recognition. They're going to take it to a new level. And this is what's fascinating to me. The goal is to turn McDonald's into, in a way, a version of Amazon. And how are they going to do that? Well, they've acknowledged that in recent years, your fast food sales have slowed. And we know that they put salads on the menu and things like that. But nobody, let's face it, is going to McDonald's for a salad. The only person eating a salad at McDonald's is the one member of the family who doesn't want to eat the hamburger. So what they've decided to do instead is to make the experience of going to McDonald's not only user-friendly, but something in which McDonald's can anticipate what it is you want to order and basically start ordering it for you. And it's fascinating to me. Right now, the chain has digital boards programmed to market that food more strategically, taking into account the factors such as the time of day, the weather, the popularity of menu items, the length of the wait. On a hot afternoon, for example, you may be able to look at that digital board and it may promote soda rather than coffee, already effectively telling you, this is what you might want to drink. At some drive-thrus, and here's the key for me, McDonald's has tested technology that can recognize your license plate number. They are keeping a data bank now. When you drive through McDonald's, you can no longer be that secret eater you wanted to be. You can't have that secret binge you thought you really were in the mood for, because as far as McDonald's is concerned, there are no secrets. They are now keeping your license plate numbers because eventually they're going to tailor a list of suggested purchases to you. Of course, they assume you're not going to change your mind. If you've always liked a cheeseburger and fries, they assume the next time you order, you're going to want a cheeseburger and fries. And they say, quote, they allow the company to tailor a list of suggested purchases as long as the, quote, person agrees to sign away the data. But I don't know how you do that. If they already have the license plate technology, how are you signing away data? And what are you doing it on? Are you doing it on your fast food receipt? Are you now agreeing to, quote, accept? You know how you agree to accept everything to move on to the next screen? Daniel Henry is the chain's chief information officer and says, we don't think food should be any different than what you buy on Amazon. At some stores, we're talking about McDonald's. At some stores, Bluetooth devices now track shoppers' movements, allowing companies to send texts and emails recommending the products that the customers lingered over and didn't buy. Now, this is talking in general about other offline experiences. Retailers are experimenting with facial recognition tools and other technologies known as offline cookies that will allow businesses to gather information about you even when you're away from your computer. And they say in the restaurant world, increasingly popular food delivery apps have produced a slew of customer data, but much of that is controlled by third-party tech companies rather than by the restaurant itself. 203-333-9422. We're talking about McDonald's and the age of technology coming to you. Let's go to Ron from Trumbull. Hi, Ron. Welcome to the show.
George Orwell must be doing cartwheels in his grave.
Can you imagine?
Oh, my God. there is no privacy anymore.
Could you imagine? You can't even sneak around for an extra fries at a drive-thru. It's unbelievable.
This is frightening that they have so much information and then can gather so much information. How do you escape it? Do you have to walk in and turn your phones off so they don't know who you are?
Not if they're gathering your license plate at a drive-thru. What can you do? You can't cover up your license plate, Ron.
Well, I don't do drive-thrus for the very reason that you can go in there and get your food faster than you can through a drive-thru. I mean, I'm not that senile or that incapacitated that I can't get out of my car and walk the 15 feet to the restaurant and talk to an individual and get my food that way. I rarely go to a place that has a drive-thru anyhow. And I guess I'm old school in terms of, I want to go in, sit down, and then take a rest.
I would like to see the figures on the percentage of people that drive through and eat in their car versus those that get out of the car. I'm going to imagine, I don't know what I'm talking about, but I think over 50% of McDonald's business is done drive through.
I wouldn't be surprised. I would not be surprised.
Because people like to eat in their cars. They like to eat in their cars. Yeah.
If I eat in my car, usually it's sitting on my lap.
Okay.
But this is crazy.
It's incredible,
right?
This is
absolutely crazy. This is a perfect example of why we should not continue to pursue AI.
Well, and listen to this. In September, McDonald's purchased another tech company called Apprente that develops voice-activated platforms that can process orders in multiple languages and accents. In recent months, McDonald's has tested voice recognition at some of its restaurants, seeking to replace the human workers who take orders with a faster system. So, in other words, this isn't about the customer now. This is about the worker. You'll be ordering from someone who isn't a human being.
I think that's the whole idea in the first place. I mean, I really think they're looking to the most expensive line item on any store or company's budget is employee sales and benefits. And if you can get rid of that, your bottom line goes up exponentially without having to do a thing.
Well, and the truth is that we have a low unemployment rate right now, and fast food restaurants are hard-pressed to find the workers to do the jobs. So simply to stay in business, they're going to have to automate.
Yeah, well, that's possible. And as a minimum wage thing continues to grow, it's even more incentive for them to start going automated.
But I will tell you that the article goes on to say, Ron, and I'm glad you called, 203-333-9422. We're talking about the technology advances of McDonald's. That's a big word, right? It's a big word. But here's what they're saying. They're saying that the critics of AI have warned that the technology will lead to a future in which humans are subordinate to machines. And not only that, AI will simply make us fatter. Because as they create more of a welcoming environment to keep ordering that really high fat, high cholesterol, high calorie, very low in nutrition food, America already has an enormous obesity problem, Ron. We're just going to get fatter and fatter. So,
I wonder with these new plant-based hamburgers and the fat rate on those things are. I don't think I've seen anything published.
It's a good question. I did see a... It's so interesting you should say that, because I just saw a whole page, you know, $50,000 ad in today's Times by one of these consortiums that probably really represents the meat industry, but basically flagged all of the chemicals and all of the... What would you call it?
Additives.
The additives, exactly, that are put into the non-meat version of the new vegetarian burgers. Because if it's not meat, it's got to be something, right? It's got to be something.
It's being grilled on the same grill with the grilling meat.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, Ron.
That's self-defeating. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. It's 16 minutes after the hour. 203-333-9422. Lots more coming up on the Lisa Wexler Show. Stay tuned.
On air, WICC 600. Online at WICC600.com. Download the WICC 600 app and Alexa skills. The Lisa Wexler Show, WICC 600.
You know, we haven't even talked about what's happening in California, and I don't know if you have any friends there, but we certainly do. It's pretty scary. PG&E is estimated to have shut off the power for as many as 2.7 million people. That's almost as many people as live in the entire state of Connecticut. And about 180,000 people have been evacuated. So think about the town you live in. Westport is 27,000. Wilton is 18,000. Norwalk has about, 60,000. Just imagine 180,000 people from our area being forced to get in their cars and go someplace. And by the way, where would you go? Have you got a good friend who's going to take you? I mean, seriously, where are you going to go? How many people can afford indefinite hotel stays? And who says that there are hotels willing to do that? You know, once they go out, your generator may not be indefinite. And, you know, my son just landed in California on Saturday. He has to be in business there for a week. And he's in Southern California, but he's making his way up to San Francisco by car. So the first thing I said is, I hope you're not going to drive on the Pacific Coast Highway. He said, no, he's going through Bakersfield. I said, okay, but just make sure you've got, you know, flashlight batteries. And he laughs at me, the LOL. I get the LOL. Because, you know, what am I? I'm a fool. You know, because he's always got his phone, right? So he knows everything. He's always got his phone. Meantime, I read today that Verizon may be shutting off power to its customers. So good luck to you with your phone. If you really have no power, you have no power. And yeah, your car may be wonderful if you can keep recharging, but what if you have no service? What if you have no service? Verizon is saying that it's going to do its best to keep service among its California customers, but it may not be able to do so. Those poor people in California. I mean, really. Between the winds, the mudslides, the rains, and the fires. It's like the trials of Job there. Anyway, Gavin Newsom, the former mayor of San Francisco, who is now the governor of California, fun fact, used to be married to that Fox News host who's now dating Donald Trump Jr. What's her name? Kim? What's the Fox News host's name? Come on, you can help me. 203-333-9422. I'm having brain freeze. She's dating Kim. She's dating Donald Trump Jr. She's a former prosecutor in California, Kimberly. I can see her face in front of me. I can't remember her name. And anyway, she had to let go her own Fox News show she was on for years. She's been on our show a number of times. Christian, you can't find it for me yet? You know who it is. Kimberly, what's her name?
Guilfoyle.
That's it. Kimberly Guilfoyle. Thank you. So here's your fun trivia fact for the day. Kimberly Guilfoyle used to be married to Gavin Newsom, who was probably the most liberal politician in office in the entire country. They used to be married to each other. And then Gavin became the mayor of San Francisco, and now he's the governor of the state of California. In the meantime, Kimberly made her career as a Fox News host, and she's now dating Donald Trump Jr., who I think is as polar opposite politically from Gavin Newsom as one could possibly be. But it's interesting, right? It's a fun fact. 203-333-9422 as we travel through the trivia that encompasses most of my mind. In the meantime, let's go to important stories. So first is California. If you want to talk about it, share. Got some thoughts on the subject. The second I must talk to you about is and then what happened story about FAA oversight, the Federal Aviation Administration. Front page story today, before crashes, Boeing pushed to undercut the FAA oversight. I read the whole thing so you don't have to. And it's such a terrible thing. So we're talking now about Boeing, and we're talking in general, the big picture and the big idea has been about the power of private enterprise to change the law via lobbying efforts in order to benefit their own industries. Now, we see this all the time. I mean, this is democracy to some extent. You've got people who represent industries. Maybe they represent the business and cattle industry, or they represent oil and gas, or they represent healthcare, or they represent manufacturers. And they go to Washington, D.C. with their suitcases, and they try and advocate on behalf of public policy. And there's supposed to be a pushback, because the people who represent us who are elected and the people who work for those who are elected are not supposed to be looking past the revolving door of leaving office in order to work for these very fancy companies at big salaries. They're supposed to have the ethics to be working in the public interest when they're on the public payroll. That's the bottom line. And that's why there are so many efforts underway and have always been underway to say, wait a minute, take a pause. If you've worked for the government, you can't work in private industry of that industry that you were regulating for at least 2-3 years. Take a pause. Don't make it such an obvious quid pro quo, because that's part of the corruption that is eating away at this country and eating away at good public policy. But when it comes to airlines, when it comes to airlines of all things and regulation of the airline industry, you and I could not have more of a stake. When you really think about it, our trains, many of our national trains, are owned by public enterprises. When you think about the subway or Metro North, these have been public entities that have been supported by tax dollars. But we don't have national airlines. The airline industry has developed as private enterprise. But one of the reasons that we in this country allowed the airline industry, which is such an important leg of our transportation, to develop privately is because there was an understanding that we had a policeman, and the policeman was the FAA, and the policeman of the FAA was thought to be incorruptible and was thought to be the kind of agency that put our interests as passengers first. Well, I'm going to read you a story or tell you a story. You don't need to read it. You could if you'd like, but I'm going to summarize it for you about just how corrupt and how awful it's become. And the specific result of how awful and corrupt it's become has been at least 600 people dying in the last 2 MAX 8 air crashes. But we don't know how much more has really happened in terms of the mechanisms that are making some of our planes not as safe as they could be or as they ought to be. So let me begin with the story. Tucked into 463 pages of legislation last year, Boeing scored one of its biggest lobbying wins, a law that undercuts the FAA's role in approving the design of new airplanes. For years and over time, the government had been handing over more responsibility to manufacturers because of the cause of reducing bureaucracy. But in this particular bill, in these particular paragraphs, the manufacturer was allowed to challenge regulators over safety disputes, and the burden of proof was shifted in such a way that it made it difficult for the FAA to then take back the authority over the company. Boeing is the nation's dominant aerospace manufacturer and the biggest beneficiary of the law. And according to the New York Times, they did an investigative report based on interviews with over 50 regulators, industry executives, and congressional staff members and lobbyists. They found that Boeing and its allies helped draft the legislation to their own liking. They overcame criticism from the regulators themselves, and they basically wrote the language of the law. The FAA warned, as the bill was being passed, that the new bill would not be in the interest of safety. That's a quote. And a labor group representing agency inspectors were concerned that the rules would turn the FAA into a rubber stamp that would, quote, be able to intervene only after a plane crashed and people were killed. And in fact, it was only weeks after the law was passed that the Boeing 737 MAX jet crashed off of Indonesia, and then the second one we know crashed after Ethiopia. But some of this article, I must tell you. Number one, we know that the FAA never fully analyzed the MCAS system, and that, of course, was the system that was the override of the pilots when the plane was going down, that it did not allow the plane to right itself and go up, despite the fact that the pilots wanted it to and then couldn't because they crashed. The plane kept going down. And just to tell you where we've been from how far we've come, in the past, agency officials in the FAA could decide whether to delegate oversight to the company or to maintain control. And now the agency, when the development process of a new plane begins, now the FAA has to hand over responsibility for certifying almost every aspect of new planes to the manufacturer itself. The law creates a committee of mostly aerospace executives to ensure that the FAA is meeting the metrics set by the industry and not the other way around. And here's the kicker that really drew my attention. This really frightened me because this is a new one to me in the history of our entire regulations. It now allows manufacturing companies in aerospace, basically Boeing, to make recommendations about the compensation of FAA employees. Now think about that. I want you to just think about that. The FAA employees, their salary is now subject to surveys and recommendations by the people that they regulate. Do you think that that should be allowed in this country? Do you think the FAA employees should have to worry about what Boeing thinks of them in terms of whether they're getting a raise next year? Or do you think it creates an impossible conflict of interest, making it impossible to do their jobs? It's outrageous. Outrageous that this passed through Congress, that FAA employees have to worry about what Boeing thinks of them in order to do their jobs. It's outrageous that they asked it, and it's outrageous that they got it. We're going to keep on this story. There's so much more to tell you. We've got Margaret Cho on the line. I can't wait to speak with her. This woman is groundbreaking. Her comedy, her attitude, her life. Can't wait to chat with her. She's going to be at the Ridgefield Playhouse very soon. Stay tuned for more of the Lisa Wexler Show on WICC 600 and WICC600.com. We'll be right back.
I feel like Fresh Off the Boat is a point of pride. You know, I'm proud of it, but the people at the network didn't like the name Fresh Off the Boat. They thought it was racist. Of course, it was all white people. It's so cute when they get offended on our behalf. Isn't that the best? It's like they're like, whoa, whoa, okay, all right, yeah. Okay, all right, all right, all right. Okay, all right, okay. That's a bit much, all right, okay.
And that voice and that attitude belongs to none other than our next guest, Margaret Cho, who is coming to our neighborhood, Aren't We Lucky, on November 15th at 8 p.m., one show only at the Ridgefield Playhouse. Margaret has an unbelievable biography, but you know what? I want her to tell us about it herself. Margaret Cho, welcome to the Lisa Wexler Show today. Hi, and thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you. That's great. Thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome. I'm delighted to have you. I was reading about your life, and basically, you've had quite a... I see that you've just turned 50, or you're 50 now. You'll be 51, so you had a bunch of decades like me to sort of enjoy it and look back over it, Margaret. But you have you've generated quite a bit of controversy in your life and your career.
I guess so. I mean, because I think I was the only Asian American female comedian when I started, pretty much. And so when you are, I guess, the other, whether it's, and I'm queer, too, on top of that. So there's a lot of things that can be controversial, possibly, but then you see society really change over the years, too. So I think it's a good thing.
Yeah. Oh, it's a fascinating thing. I always associate it with bravery.
Yes. Thank you.
So, and I want to know what the definition of queer is. And please, you know, I don't mean to be in any way... I'm definitely ignorant, but I don't mean to be in any way condescending, but the conversation and the definitions are changing mm-hmm. for a lot of people, yeah. And I would really like to know, when you identify as queer, what does that mean?
Well, I am bisexual, but I think that is somehow actually also incorrect, because it says sort of that there's only two genders, which I also don't believe. I think gender is really infinite, and nowadays, there's so many people identifying as gender fluid or non-binary, which I think is more appropriate. However, bisexual is kind of an older term that I think people have used, but queer used to be a slur, of course.
Yes.
And then it's something that was reclaimed by our community in a way to identify ourselves and, you know, overcome the stigma. And so I applied that, I used to, like, as queer to refer to myself, but it is always changing. And but what I love about it is that it's like young people now are really calling the shots in terms of how they want to be addressed, what pronouns they want to use. I think that is such, I don't know, such progress, and it's really encouraging.
We're chatting with Margaret Cho, who's coming to the Ridgefield Playhouse soon. You can get your tickets very easily at the Ridgefield Playhouse. And she's coming on, November 15th. So that's, yeah, it's pretty soon. So, and, you know, in looking at your biography, if you don't mind, and of course, I sourced it with Wikipedia. If they're wrong, just come out and say so.
Uh-huh.
But
yeah,
it looked like you had a pretty, in many ways, awful and abusive teen years that you've spoken about. Terrible.
Yes, and I think that that's really kind of what I think a lot of comedians have, a sort of a tragic past. I think comedy, or like the ability of a humorist, is really about somebody who copes with a lot of things. And coping is something that you get good at when you've been bullied, when you've been feeling like you didn't belong, if you felt very different, if you're dealing with abuse. And so for me, I think being, I guess, a comedian really is something about that. Like, there's something to that. Like, if we're overcoming things, that we're better at being funny or making ourselves laugh, which is the most important.
Well, I think you're right. It's the key coping mechanism. I mean, I grew up in a very, what I consider to be, happy home, but I looked at it also very much like a Neil Simon comedy, because I had very exaggerated personalities in my group, let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided long ago that to look at life sideways and to laugh about it was the best way that I could enjoy my life.
Yes, it really is. And it's a way that we can get one up on society, get one up on the environment we're in. And it's a way to overcome it. So I think it's actually a really good coping mechanism.
But even when you're laughing at it, it sounds to me like in your life where you had some substance abuse issues and some other kinds of self-destructive behavior, that some of it caught up with you anyway, Margaret.
Well, it always does. And also the lifestyle of a comedian. I mean, it's kind of like musicians. That's very close. That's why we're always friends with musicians, because we have the same kind of schedule and the same kind of environment. And so it's something that does kind of breed addiction. If you have it in you already, it's very easy to fall into it. And, you know, it's something that I realize it's almost like when you grow up with some kinds of abuse, then you kind of want to continue it in a way. It's in your subconscious. And so that's been my main problem, I think, in everything, is trying to parent myself and be an adult.
Because you say you were sexually molested by a family friend for years.
Yes, but that was so common. If you think about how young girls in the 1980s were looked at by society, mm-hmm. and, you know, if you look at even at like the Roman Polanski movie Tess, you know, she's 16 in that movie. It's really like the way that we viewed young women. I mean, from Brooke Shields to Christy McNichol to all of these sort of icons of like film and, you know, television, and also like this, just like atmosphere. This is so common, and only more recently did we think of this as a very dangerous and taboo thing. So I feel like, you know, I'm definitely not the only one that this happened to.
No, I am.
And also, it was more than one abuser. You know, this was like the world was really an abuser. You were experiencing that kind of that gaze at early as 10, maybe before, you know, and so I think that anybody who was around at that time and was that age at that time has a lot to deal with.
We're chatting with Margaret Cho. Margaret, did your parents, when they, I mean, first of all, did they live long enough to hear you talk about all of this? And like, how did they react? And what kind of a, some insight into the Korean culture in terms of your parents finding out about this behavior. How did they cope with it?
Well, they're still alive, and they're still very much a part of they do a lot of weight-bearing exercise, so they're very good at kind of like dealing with life on life's terms. And
okay.
And so they, you know, we went to therapy, which is was really hard, actually, because they didn't really, that part of it, I thought, was very hard for them to understand, to kind of air everything out. But they went with me, and they're very, I think they're very understanding of it. I think that there's a part of all Asian cultures that has a stoic silence around suffering. I think because of all the wars that went on. And so you do have a kind of acceptance around it, but also a need to keep secrets, which I think is dangerous. But that's where our cultures really divide, whereas sort of American culture is really about putting everything out in the open to heal, whereas Korean culture can be very much about silencing it. So that's where we kind of have a great divide. But fortunately, you know, my parents are old enough in their mid-80s now to be able to cope with that too, you know. So they've lived in a world that everything changes, and that's good.
Well, Margaret Cho, which is better, do you think? Is the Asian way of coping? Because, you know, there's conversation about how repression, for example, Holocaust survivors, the first generation of survivors, many of them never discussed their experiences with their children. They had other kinds of demons, don't get me wrong. I know plenty of kids who grew up with parents who survived the Holocaust, and there were certain pathologies that definitely were in the house, but there was a lot of studying done that showed that the repression of some of their most intense suffering actually enabled them to rebuild their lives as healthily as they possibly could. And I'm just wondering, since you've spent so much of your life and you're so bright thinking about Asian versus Western culture, which do you think is healthier or better? Is it better to keep talking about everything, or is it better to put some things in the past and not? What do you think?
I don't know. For me, it's always felt better to talk about things, but I think that's because I feel very much I'm so, well, that's very lesbian to process everything and talk about it.
Like, oh, really?
You know, that's my lesbian side really coming through, where I just want to examine.
Okay.
And I just want to take over and take it apart. And, you know, so for me, I've always found that it's better to just talk about it.
Okay. All right, we're chatting with Margaret Cho, who's coming into Richfield on November 15th. I just have to ask you about one line that I saw in your wiki. I must ask about this because I'm so curious. It says that a while ago you were interviewed by a New York Times reporter, and you, at one point in your life, you were a dominatrix. First of all, is that true?
Yeah, but it was only for like about a day. It was only for a couple of minutes.
Oh,
I was
really?
So bad at it.
I want to know about
it.
Tell me about it. Tell
now,
me.
I was also working at this place, this like a lesbian BDSM collective, where we were making tried to sit in with some of the customers' clients, and it was not good. But I think there's something to it. You know, there's a great, you know, I think the sexuality is so interesting, and when people are able to be free and do all sorts of different things, but I'm not a top in any way.
A what?
So that to me is very new.
You're
but
not
I'd like to be better at it.
You're not a what?
Top.
A what?
A top. A top.
Oh, a top.
A
T-O-P?
Top or a bottom.
Oh, okay.
A sadist or a master.
Oh, okay.
You know, like,
oh, okay.
A top is somebody who does, and a bottom is somebody who receives.
I see. Okay.
So
okay.
I'm more of a receiver.
Okay. Okay. You know, it's a completely new vocabulary to me, Margaret. What can I tell you? But I did see that, and I thought that's really something. So you're very willing to experiment in life, Margaret Cho, right? That's your life.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Always.
What are you most happy about right now? Like, what gives you the most joy?
Well, I love my dog. Her name is Lucia. She is 11 months old. She's a rescue dog. She's a Chihuahua.
Aww.
And so I'm really enjoying all her array of Halloween costumes.
that you're putting
to put.
I have, yes. Shayna on my lap right now. My dog also is not quite 11 months. She turned one October 13th, so she's 10 and a half months.
Ooh.
And she's a little Bichon cotton ball fluff, and she comes with me throughout my day, and she comes with me. I'm a judge in the afternoon, so she comes with me to court. And and I'm with you on the dog thing. That's what gives me joy. Absolutely.
Isn't it great?
Oh, yeah.
The young ones are so fun. I've had many different dogs in different ages, and for the last several years of living with older dogs. So a new one is a very different experience. I forgot how it was to raise a puppy.
Me too. So it had been about 14 years for us. I know. And she's right now a little bit insistent and whimpery. But, you know, it keeps you young to have young people and young animals in your life. It's a good thing, Margaret, right? It's a good thing.
It's so true. It's so true. I have a lot of young people in my life and a lot of animals, but she's the youngest.
Yeah.
So she's the best.
Are you traveling with her to Richfield? Do you bring her with you on the road?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Sure.
She'll be there.
Good. I'm glad. So, is there anything you want to let us know? Any kind of, I don't know, statement you want to make to our audience about what's happening in the world, politics, your show, anything in particular on your mind you want to share?
There's so much to say.
I know.
There's so much to say. There's too much. But I think people should come. I mean, it's like, you know, we've never experienced this kind of world, I think, and where everybody's on the same page about everything. So it's really fun to do comedy, and it's really fun to go see comedy. So everybody should come.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure they're going to have a great time, Margaret. And, you know, I'm thinking about you and reading your bio and following your career all these years. I will say I would definitely have to say again that I think you've been very brave.
Oh, thank you.
And I really admire brave people.
Thank you. That's wonderful.
I think courage is under-discussed and undervalued. And, you know, when you put yourself out there for whatever it is you believe, right? Whatever it is you believe, if you know you're going to get flack, and particularly in the Hollywood that we're now uncovering was even skeevier than we even thought it was, and you were right in there. You were right in there.
Yes. Yes. And it's crazy to know, like, now we can actually have a way to say no and to stop it, which I think is really important. And it's important for young people in Hollywood now. I think it's a lot better than it was. I'm really glad for that.
I hope it is. I mean, you talk about a little bit about how they made you lose so much weight and you got so sick and you went into, what, kidney failure or something like that? And
all these
unreasonable demands.
It's canceled and replaced by Drew Carey because he's so thin.
Oh, my. Is that really what happened? That's unbelievable.
Yes. That's the thing about is that we're held up to such a double standard. And I think, you know, for women and men, it's very bad. So I think that's really funny, too. But it's really, I think things are changing.
Well, I'm glad. I hope that they are. And if they're changing, it's because of, you know, people like you who forced them to change along the way, you know, a little bit.
Yes. Well, thank you.
So
thank
Margaret you. Cho at the Richfield Playhouse, November 15th. Don't forget to get your tickets right away. And I thank you very much for being on the Lisa Wexler Show today, Margaret. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
You take care. We'll be right back. I don't know. I feel like the Carol Burnett Show half the time. You know what I mean? When she would say, seems we just get started. And before you know it, comes the time we have to stay so long. Not quite. We've got 10 minutes. 203-333-9422. And you can say a lot in 10 minutes. You can fit in a lot. But still, the show zooms by, doesn't it? And you can listen to it without commercials on SoundCloud.com in the evenings. You will find the link on WICC600.com. Or you can very easily go on iTunes, on the podcast. Just Google Lisa Wexler Show. It'll come right up for you. Easy peasy. 203-333-9422. 203-333-9422. All right, let's see if we've got some other news you may have missed in so many of my stories today. We touched briefly, obviously, on the killing of al-Baghdadi and President Trump from the White House. Talking about how significant it was that he has been killed. He blew himself up, apparently, as well as taking the life of his wife and children with him. And many people giving President Trump full credit for approving the operation that led to the demise of Baghdadi. But Brett McGurk, who served under President George W. Bush as senior director for Iraq and Afghanistan, and also served as special envoy under both Presidents Trump and Obama for the coalition to defeat ISIS, wrote this: "Trump deserves full credit for approving the operation that led to Baghdadi's demise. It's a shame the information that led to the raid apparently did not come to him before the tragic decision to abruptly pull U.S. special forces from much of northeastern Syria. Because everything we already know about the raid reinforces just how valuable, unique, and hard-fought the small and sustainable American presence there had been." So, during a 48-minute White House appearance, President Trump said, when we landed, recounting the raid, said, when we landed with 8 helicopters, a large crew of brilliant fighters ran out of those helicopters and blew holes into the side of the building, not wanting to go through the main door because that was booby-trapped. And he said he watched it as if he was watching a movie. In the meantime, firefighters are doing their best to fight all of the fires in California as the Kincade Fire wore down yesterday. Up to 2.8 million Californians, including 1.3 million in the Bay Area, had no power yesterday as Pacific Gas and Electric Company implemented its largest ever purposeful blackout to prevent wildfires during a fierce windstorm, prompting Governor Gavin Newsom to declare a state of emergency in order to deploy, quote, every resource available to fight the blazes. This news bit is probably worthy of a much longer piece. Maybe we'll get into it tomorrow. Young Americans are embracing socialism by name at a rate that we've never before seen. 50% of millennials and 51% of Generation Z, they come after the millennials, have a somewhat or very unfavorable view of capitalism. But nearly, let me show you the stats here. Do I have the graph here? Over 50% were willing to elect somebody who was self-labeled a socialist. And some of the commentary says that it's because they've grown up in a country where economic inequality has climbed, where they have more than their fair share of student loan debt as a burden, where they feel like they cannot achieve the American dream that their parents did, which is unlike every generation before them that always felt that they would live better than their parents. So if you're of a certain age, maybe over 50, you probably recall the house you grew up in. And if you look at the house you live in now, it probably has more bathrooms, more square footage, nicer cabinetry, nicer appliances. It's probably altogether a nicer home. I'm talking statistically speaking, than your parents lived in. Or if it isn't in a nicer home, because you've chosen to exchange an urban setting for a suburban one, at least it's something you've chosen because you wanted to have maybe an apartment environment different than maybe where you grew up. But for most of us over 50, if we look at the material luxury that we live in now, it's significantly different, a significantly different footprint than the material luxury our parents lived in. That being, quote unquote, the American dream. Maybe part of the problem is that we've defined the American dream materialistically too much, too subscribed to material goods. But in any event, it's certainly important when we think about prosperity overall and living in freedom and living in comfort. We think about that. And we want that. And we want our children to have what we've had. And this is the first generation statistically that doesn't believe they're going to get to where we have. I'm talking about we over the age of 50. That's a frightening thing, but what's even more frightening is that they really perceive an answer to be socialism. And that tells me a couple of things. Number one, it tells me that they've been very poorly educated in our schools, public mostly, maybe private as well. Very poorly educated if they believe socialism is the issue, is the answer. If they believe that creating a redistribution of wealth forcibly and putting more and more of our lives into the hands of government agencies is the answer, then I would like to show them a country that's ever been run socialist and see if they've liked living there, because I can guarantee the standard of living has been far lower. Because even countries like Sweden and Norway that have certain social welfare policies are hardly socialist countries. They are capitalist countries. And so it tells me that either the teachers in our schools have been leading people astray, or the media that these kids have been imbibing has been leading people astray, but someone has been poorly influencing an entire two generations of people below us if they really believe that socialism is going to help them. And it's scary, because it's scary for the future of this country. In the meantime, just let's see. This is some economy. Pay raises are slowing in a weakening economy. Could be foreshadowing things to come. And packages are snarling up New York City like never before. Because New York City is trying to cope with the daily delivery of 1.5 million packages. Thank you, Amazon. The immense changes in New York have been driven by tech giants. And often the city has not been involved or even aware. And it is snarling New York City at a rate never before seen. So as we're trying to make our cities more pedestrian friendly, we ironically have more people that are delivering more things to more people that they have to have within 24 hours. Because that's what we have to do. And in the meantime, did you hear this? Let's go to the audio cut of Donald Trump last night at the baseball game. Donald Trump last night at Game 5 of the World Series, where the Houston Astros beat the Nationals 7-1, moving them to 3-2. And instead, Donald Trump wasn't there, pardon me. He was there. Chef, philanthropist, and Trump critic Jose Andres threw out the ceremonial first pitch. Donald Trump was there but decided not to throw out the first pitch. But here are some of the chants that greeted him. Christian, you got it for me? If you didn't hear that, there were chants last night of lock him up, which were distinctly reminiscent of the chants at many different Trump rallies in which he chanted memorably lock her up, referring to Hillary Clinton. And now last night at a baseball game, the audience was chanting lock him up. 203-333-9422 is our number, but we're coming up on noon. And that means we've got Clark Howard coming up ahead from 12 to 2. And then our own Paul Pacelli with Connecticut Today from 2 to 6. And Paul does a great job every day of talking about issues that are mattering right here in our community. Our call-in number remains the same. It's 203-333-9422. Be part of our WICC community. And I will be back behind the mic tomorrow. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Lisa Wexler.